Would you turn with me again to the Gospel according to John and John chapter 14? And perhaps by way of a text this morning, lead in to this passage, we might just remind ourselves of verse 6 as Jesus' answer to the question of Thomas. Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." It seems to come very easily to men, people, to get puzzled and worried and agitated over all sorts of things in life, and I suspect most of you will do that from time to time at least. It may seem a bit of a stereotype, but it does actually happen in Australia that you hear people's response when you're concerned about something, you express a concern or whatever, and they'll say, "No worries." And they actually mean it, generally speaking. That is their way of thinking, that they say, don't worry, it's not a problem, don't get agitated. And in a way, they're making a contribution to your life as you may be thinking about something that... Think about those words. And that's what Jesus does as he speaks to his disciples. He is making a contribution to their lives. It's something that they needed to get installed in their thinking and to go on from here. It is, of course, on a much bigger and a more enduring scale that Jesus speaks here. Having said that, remember, as we come to this passage, that Jesus is, on that occasion, he's tucked away in a room where there's all the hustle and bustle of whatever it is of Jerusalem at that time. He's tucked away with just these faithful disciples. One of them has left. There are 11 left. He knows, they don't, but he knows that there is not much time left. Remember, this is the evening. It was night already when Judas went out. And as we come to a little later on, after he, that glorious prayer in chapter 17, they go out into the night and Jesus is arrested and in no time at all crucified. He knows there's not much time left. Not only will he soon be going to his death, but he knows too that when that happens, especially on his arrest, it immediately happens, that these disciples would be startled, they would be agitated, they would be extremely anxious. And remember, this follows immediately after he has warned Peter that he was going to deny him. That was the measure of their agitation. This is what's going to happen. Even Peter, this bold man Peter, is going to be brought so low. And so Jesus says, "Don't let your heart be troubled." He speaks first of all to those 11 men. "I know that you're going to be troubled. Don't be." And he provides further reinforcement, instruction to assure them that there is no need for their heart to be troubled. When all of that comes about, when their present peace will be under assault and shattered, don't let it be troubled. Here is the alternative. There are not many people whose minds, in the world even today, whose minds and hearts will be, as we say, at peace. So many things can bother people and take that peace away. So many people worry about tomorrow and what lies beyond in their future. There's all the uncertainty of life, and there's in the life that we live, there seems for so many an apparent lack of answers. People are frustrated and they're on a never-ending search, and people ask the question, "How can we know?" There is a great desire to know things. And there is also an immense compulsion, not just from outside but within the heart of man, also to what we call succeed, whatever that means to different people. Isn't it true that such things, the future, how to know things, how to succeed, Are these not some of the great things that people face and do get anxious over in life? Some of the most significant worries. And I would draw these to your attention because I think in this passage, when he says, first of all, let not your heart be troubled, he goes on to say, well, what instead? He deals with those very things. Just a few words that he has to say, which do and can and should settle all of those points. It's a bit like when you are learning to write English and you're learning to spell. There's such things as that very useful rule of I before E except after C. You just remember that rule and you come to the word receive and you know how to spell it. You come to the word believe and you know how to spell it. Simple. It's one of the most remarkable expressions, I think, that Jesus gives us. The words, the simple words, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And so much that is encapsulated in that. In these few, I think, very memorable words, Jesus tells us where to start. When you see that trouble coming, your heart is getting stirred to trouble, come back here. He does it very briefly. We have to do the same this morning. But I think he does show us from there and through this, even just this passage, these few verses, he tells us where to take those more detailed worries that I've just referred to. I think the passage tells us that there is one way to peace. There's one way to all of these things, one way to peace, one way to a future, a real future. There's one way to know. There's one way to succeed. But most of all, there is one way to the Father. And I would like to draw these to your attention this morning as Jesus speaks. You need peace? There is one way to peace. And so on. One way to peace. As I've pointed out, reminded you, we must remember that Jesus was here dealing with the needs, in the immediate case, of these 11 men, the needs that would arise shortly after this encounter in this room. But there is, for all that it is specifically for them, there is as well, I think, a real comprehensiveness about this statement, this assurance. Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. For all who do say, I believe in God, such a statement applies. It applies across that vast range of human troubles of spirit. But only, I say, only if they're taken as they were first meant. Only provided those calming words. So often I have heard people say, well, Jesus said, let not your heart be troubled. And it stops there, but there is not a full stop in that sentence. It must be taken as a part of the whole that he said. The precise nature of the trouble that the disciples would face is one that underlies so much of what people do deal with. Or perhaps we should say what people can't deal with. What Jesus was anticipating, what he knew would happen, was that there would be a collapse of their hopes of a better life. Now I say that because that's the way that the disciples, that's the way that the people of Israel, of Judah then, the Jews, that's the way they were thinking. They were looking for God's Messiah, God's Savior, God's Deliverer, his Redeemer, and expecting a much better life, a more peaceful life in this life. They wanted a sense that God really did care for his people. So many, even in this country and our generation, would like to think that God will only be kind to them. And that kind needs a definition as well. They think that God is, they're taught that God is love, and they have their own perception of what that love should mean. that they will be comfortable, that you will be comfortable, that it will keep them from suffering of trouble of all kinds. Isn't that what God is about? Isn't God loving? That was very close to the prevailing mindset of these 11 men, let alone the people around them on that night in Jerusalem. And that's the mind that Jesus addresses here. Do you want to find peace when you could so easily be dragged down by those things that do afflict man? Job said, man is born to trouble. The way that Jesus answers whatever is before these people, and that particular kind of hope, is to say, well, don't think about yourself, don't think about those things, think about me. This was his provision, to set them, instead of looking at the preconceived idea, the hopes that they had, the hopes that the nation had built up, instead of looking at those things, he says, look at me. And it strikes me as I read this that he says this so soon before deliberately setting out on a path that was only ever going to lead to his destruction. The worst possible suffering he was going out to meet it head on. And he says it's for you. And in the middle of all that he says, let not your heart be troubled. Believe in me. It was exactly that Jesus, the suffering Jesus, who they were to dwell on, who we are to dwell on, who was saying to them, I give myself, believe in me. Do you believe in God? I'm not sure quite how far back it was. It was probably about three or five years ago. But somebody did, one of these polls, or it was possibly even in the previous census about 10 years ago. But there's a question as to who believes in God. And in Britain, they said the number came out at about 72, something like that, percent. People will say, I believe in God. Well, let's say take this. Jesus says, you believe in God? I think what he's saying is, if you do believe in the true God, the God who is revealed in the Bible, you will also believe in me. And that's the crux of the matter. That's the dividing point. And unless you cross that dividing point, that dividing line, your heart will continue to be troubled. Do you believe in God, he says? There'll be a time when that belief in God, if you continue with the set of mind that you have at the moment, that your hopes are founded on this earth and the prosperities of this earth. If that's where your hopes lie and that you think God is after looking after you in that respect and going no further, then those things will be shattered. You will feel shaken in your thinking on God. It will only be answered. You will only find peace. You will only be able to avoid the trouble of spirit and heart that he speaks about if you believe in Jesus. That's what he says here. Let not your heart be troubled. Answer, you believe in God? You do believe in God. He knew they believed in God. He says, believe also in me. And yes, it is in just the briefest words, but he's been teaching them, and he goes on to teach them. And he has gone on teaching us what it means to believe in him. The true Jesus, the true God found in Jesus. If you take belief in God all the way, to believe in Jesus, this will take the trouble away from your soul. I think this is expanded on when we go on further and see what other things that are covered here. I'm speaking about next one way to a future, because this is one of the things that troubles man's heart. he expands on what this means, the implications for the troublous spirit that will otherwise come on us. The two disciples that we read of in Luke chapter 24, two disciples who were leaving Jerusalem on the first day of the week, sometime a few days after this, and they were trudging along, it seems. You can almost picture them with their shoulders bowed as they were muttering to each other. And Jesus draws alongside and he asks them a question. And within their answer, they say this, Luke 24, verse 21, they say, we're hoping that it was he, this Jesus, who was going to redeem Israel. But that tells you that their hopes had vanished because of his betrayal, because of his arrest, because of his crucifixion. Their hopes had gone. They had not understood what that crucifixion was about. Their hearts were troubled, still troubled. They had not yet found what it meant to believe in this Jesus as he meant it here. But their hopes, their prospects for what was ahead, they'd vanished, gone. But this night he had told them what was in store for them if they held their faith. It was an extension of the peace that he promises them. You believe also in me? And then he goes on, verses 2 and 3, in my Father's house are many mansions or rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you, I go to prepare a place for you. I will come again and receive you to myself. I will. I am going on to do this. It is a future. I will do it. Look at the logic of it. He says, I'm going this way, and if I'm going that way to prepare a place for you, I'm surely going to come back and I'm going to take you to take up your place. There is a future ahead of you. Their hopes were vanished. They had hoped he would redeem Israel. He was going to redeem Israel, but in this new way. They had not yet perceived. One of the great glories of that passage is from that vanished hope, that destroyed hope. He teaches them from the scriptures and their hearts start to burn and the hope builds up because it's redirected to such a thing as this. He promises those who believe in God and believe in him, he promises a rich and a secure future. My Father's house. My Father was his name for God. They knew that, I believe, from what he had been teaching. In his house. And I'm there preparing a place for you. The richest possible future. Great inheritance. They had been hoping for that. But in a very misguided way. It was within this same room that there had been an argument, Mark tells us, over who would be greatest in his kingdom when he came into his kingdom. That's the kingdom he's talking about, my Father's house, the place that I'm preparing for you. But it's a far surer, much finer future than can be ever imagined, beyond all that we set our minds on in this world. It's through him. He is the way for a life. He is the way for a future. A real future. The futures they had hoped for, to have a king who sits on a gold throne there, who could set back the Romans for some period of time, and they could be sitting there, James on one side, John on the other, Peter somewhere nearby keeping things in order, and then it would pass. They'd be gone. Not this one. It's in my Father's house, a place for you. And by very implication, it's an enduring place, a real future. It's through believing in him. Where I go, that you may be there also. Believe. Do you believe? There is just this one way. Believe all that he was, all that he is about, all that he has promised. believe all that he has said, all that he is, all that he does, all that he will do. And he will give you life. I am the way, the truth, and the life. The great confession of the ages that we used earlier concludes with, I believe in the life everlasting. One way to a future. There's one way also to know. I can only touch on this because this is such a great aspect of human life. You could ask the question, what do you want to know? So many want to know things that are just bound up in this world. If we take what Jesus says, though, this truly answers the fundamental question of knowledge. First of all, Jesus spoke about knowing the way to where he was going. Verse 4, where I go, you know, and the way you know. Thomas said, I don't. What is the way? He's talking about the way to his Father's house, the way of the future. He speaks a little further down in verse 7. If you had known me, you would have known my Father also. He himself is the way into knowing God. It's interesting that this particular question, or this particular assertion that Jesus makes, that you do know. From now on, you know him and have seen him. It's these two things that the disciples question. Thomas first, then Philip in verse 8. How do we know the way? How do we know the Father? Are these the two greatest of the questions of knowledge? Jesus says it is through me, only through me. For the way, those who know Jesus know the way. I am the way. So very simply worded, it's very far-reaching. To know the Father, God, which of the teachers then or now tells the truth about God? Which of the faiths, as they're called, which of the religions tells the truth about God? It was in Hebrews chapter 2, it tells us that God spoke by the prophets ages on ages, and then At the last, in the last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, who, being the brightness of his glory and the express image of his person. You know Jesus, you've seen Jesus, you've seen the Father. From now on, you know him and have seen him. Philip asked the question, show us the Father. I almost feel sorry for Jesus, but then I realize I'm probably much like Philip. He who has seen me has seen the Father. I've been with you all this time. You've been seeing the Father. He is the clearest revelation of the Father to man. Which of the teachers tells the truth so that you can know? I am the truth. Only the truth will tell any man of such a being as God, the Father. And this is that, therefore, it is that comprehensive, it's that all-encompassing provision that we have need of to know. You know God, you will know things as they truly are. But he also goes on and he deals with that great question that is so, so powerful in our day, in our part of the world. There's one way to succeed. And there are churches around which will talk about this at great lengths. But again, it's much like that I before E, except after C. It's like the formula for the area of a triangle. You learn it, you remember it, you can carry it through, you can apply it. One way to succeed, this very powerful desire, and it's not just in the Western world, I think it is present in every part of the world, it's part of man's fallen nature. It's interesting how if you read people arguing for evolutionary theory, how success is so important. survival of the fittest is what rates highest. Survival reckoned to be success. The one who dies, he's failed. You survive, you've succeeded. Success, it runs through so much of man's thinking. Yes, the survival of other species is right, it's good, it's a successful thing from a biblical point of view, I think. But common perceptions of such things, success, need to be very closely examined. And when you do that, you find an answer here. For many people, success you might simply define as getting what you want. Some want millions of pounds. Some want, well, you name it. How do you define it? And once you get it, that's your measure of success. So how do you get what you want? Men go about it in all sorts of different ways, don't they? Take you back to the disciples for a moment. I think what they were looking for, their hopes, remember, that were dashed. Think about what those hopes were. And they were essentially hopes along the lines of what most men think of. Their presumption that what was best for them was to have a great future with this up-and-coming king, to sit on his right hand, to sit on his left, one of them to be the greatest, and down in a succeeding order. Success, as the world thinks about it. And then people are looking for that, and they come to Jesus' words, and somehow or other, all too often, read them like this. In verses 13 and 14, such words sound very sweet. Whatever you ask, in verse 13, that I will do. In verse 14, if you ask anything, I will do it. Is that what it says? That's what it's read. But it's not what it says. That's the idea of people's success. They will come to God and they will say, I believe in God, but God must give me what I want. And then they read this and they say, well, God says if I ask what I want, he will give it to me. Didn't he actually say, most assuredly, I say to you, he who believes in me, the works that I do, he will do also, and greater works than these he will do, because I go to my Father. And whatever you ask in my name, that I will do, that the Father may be glorified in the Son. If you ask anything in my name, I will do it. He does present you with a road to sure, absolutely certain success. But it depends if you're on that road, on his way, the way of truth. Some people might say, well, it sounds like you're shifting the goalposts. No, it's man who shifted the goalposts. We've been heading completely the wrong road, that broad road that is easy, but leads to destruction. You will get what you want and ask for. But make sure that you're very clear that your wishes, your desires, your aims, your ambitions are heading in the right direction. The hopes, the future, peace, knowledge, such things. Are they on the right path? He is the way of life. If you were to turn over to James chapter 4, I'll just quote verse 3. You ask and do not receive because you ask amiss. And what is amiss with that? It's because you want to spend it on your pleasures. What is Jesus saying here? He says, if you ask in my name, if you're in the Son, the Father may be glorified. It's about the Father. It's about God. Psalm 37 verse 4 says, delight yourself also in the Lord. Let that be the delight of your heart, and he will give you the desires of your heart. No questions asked. Where is my mindset? Where is your heart devoted? And that brings us to the last of these things, and I think the foundation of all of them, and most certainly the foundation of Jesus' own life and death. One way to the Father. Isn't that what verse 6 says? I am the way, the truth, and the life. And what matters most about this way, truth, and life is that no one comes to the Father except through me. He is the way to the Father. The Father is the life. That's where you will find the life. What matters most to Jesus? I remember doing, you've perhaps seen them once or twice, one of these things. You can do it on the computer, and it's a word cloud, they call it. And I actually produced it on the service sheet probably a year or so ago. And it was on this chapter, this section, John 14. And it's one where it picks out the frequency of the words and it just pictures them. And the largest words in largest print are the most common words. And Father was certainly amongst the largest. See how often in just 14 verses, and there's more to come, how often Jesus turns the disciples to think on the Father, because that's where he's thinking. People want peace. Take your belief in God to its full extension. The Son came because the Father sent him. Do you believe in God? You must believe in Jesus if that belief is to have any credibility. And then you will find peace by trusting in Jesus. You want a future? He is the way. The best prospect possible and available can be entered into through Jesus, into the Father's house, because that's where he wants to be. Knowledge? Don't reduce yourself. Don't underestimate yourself. Don't limit yourself to the knowledge of man. Come through Jesus, and you will know the Father. You will know him personally, because he is a person. He's saying it is possible to know the Father. It is possible to know God. And that's what he wants for you most of all. We don't know the way. Jesus answered, I am the way. And what matters most about being the way is that you can come to the Father through that way. That's what he wants for you most of all. Why do we want anything less? It will take time to grow in that knowledge, and there might be times in life where you say, but I don't feel as though I know the Father. But don't give up. Keep coming through this way. It will take long, and it will take longer the less you occupy yourself with him. And then there's success that the world longs after so much and eats up people so much. Question is, how do you measure it? It's not a lowest common denominator. There's no need for that. But the very highest. Yes, it's your potential, you might say. Not a prosperity gospel at all. It's just the gospel of Jesus, because that's what he wants for you. That you will have what he wants, what the Father wants, because that's the desire of your heart. And this is probably what is the most challenging, the most demanding for any man, for you. It is to transform your desire, the great object of your heart, the great longing. Look at Jesus. I've said it already, how the Father preoccupies him. Is that you? That's what needs to be changed. None of this was about Jesus. Much of it was about you, but it was about taking you to glorify the Father, to give you to the Father, that he might be glorified. Through much of this, Jesus has prayed that he would be glorified, but it was again in order that the Father would be glorified in him, repeatedly. As I read this, I find that we are faced with the question, why? why should the great God have any interest in me? Why does he choose to bring glory to himself through sinners? Because this is what this is talking about. This is about, if you is another big word in that word cloud. Just you. But you and the Father. That's what Jesus is doing. There is one God, there is one mediator between God and man, the man Christ Jesus, who gave himself a ransom for all, as Paul says. Why? Because it is to his glory. Because it is so otherwise incomprehensible. It is otherwise so unbelievable that it does bring him glory, but he does it. But he only does it through his Son. Three words cover everything. I am the way, the truth, and the life. There's no escape from those things. And if you try to say that something else doesn't fall under that umbrella, and that you want to find another route of life, you just cannot do it. The only way of life is Jesus. No one comes to the Father except through me. We're wise if we go this way, if we make it our great desire, only desire, to find and to know and to follow God. And we will find him in this Jesus. That's the glory of the gospel. It tells you about him. It shows you him. It means that you can know him, and through knowing him, to know the Father. And therefore, let not your heart be troubled, but only therefore. If you will not take the rest, you don't have a right to that. And it will not answer. You will always remain in trouble of spirit. But believe in God, believe also in me, because I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. So may he set his blessing on our hearts and our lives by his word today. Let us pray together.